quotations from Chairman Mao Zedong, which is probably the best-selling book in the world today, and unfortunately also the most influential book in the world today. There are at least a million people in the world that are either being subjected to its influence or are avidly reading it because they are interested in what it has to say to them about achieving what they want to achieve in the world. It is a book which was put together about 3 years ago. This particular one is first edition with printing in 1966, printed in Peking, China, with the picture of Mao and the frontispiece and a foreword written by Lin Biao, who is the head of the army and is generally thought at the present time, if he manages to survive, to be Mao's successor. It is simply a collection of sentences or paragraphs which are taken from various writings, various speeches of Mao Zedong, and are gathered together under 33 different topics. So it is not an organized piece of writing that goes coherently paragraph by paragraph treating the theme, but it is a collection of sayings on a number of topics, beginning with Communist Party, classes and class struggle, socialism and communism, and so on, and ending up with the topic youth, women, culture, and art, and study. Now, among other things here at home in the last couple of weeks, we've been in some of the sessions which I've had, I've been talking about this. In order to talk about it, we've spent 3 hours and 3 separate days to talk about it. I'm going to talk about it in 1 hour with you today. So, what I decided to do is to approach it a bit differently from the way I did the last couple of weeks. What we attempted to do in the last couple of weeks was to trace by means of this book Mao's basic revolutionary technique, in other words, how to take over a country which you want to convert to communism, having taken it over by a successful revolutionary war, how you pacify it and convert it from a non-communist country to a communist country. I think one can very clearly work out from this book Mao's technique, how to do it. It has been successful in China, in Cuba. It was unsuccessful in Bolivia, among other reasons, because Guevara didn't follow the book. Started out following the book and then he departed from it in a very basic way and finally was captured and was executed by the Bolivian police, as far as we know. And the basic document which is used in Cuba in the revolutionary schools. I think other documents are used in Russia in training of revolutionaries there. Mao's brand of communism, I think, is much more significant politically than Russian communism, although Russian communism has been around for a much longer time. The basic reason why it is significant is because it is much more attractive to people who are of a revolutionary bent, even much more attractive to people who are unhappy with the kind of country they have, the kind of government they have. And there are certain things about it which have their appeal. Russian communism has always appeared rather brutal, the Leninist, Stalinist variety of communism, and even intellectuals who have been communists have always found it necessary to defend to themselves and to others what was happening in Russia, was happening in the satellite countries of Eastern Europe. In terms of the goodness of the ultimate goal that was intended to be achieved, sheet, that everybody was going to live better, rather than a few people living well, that everybody was going to live better. And at times, when people were being slaughtered left and right, it was rather difficult to justify this kind of behavior in terms of the final good that supposedly was going to come out of it. Now, Miles' writings appear much more attractive, and I'll try to explain some of these things that do have their appeal to people. And so consequently, it is a much more insidious form of communism to attempt to combat, and makes a much, surprisingly enough, a much stronger foe than Russian communism. I suspect this probably may be one of the reasons why Castro in Cuba has been much more consistently pro-Chinese than the Russians, even though the Russians have done most of the financing of this revolution. And why in Africa and in some areas of Central and South America, the kind of communism which is being pushed and the kind of revolutions which are being pushed are Chinese communist in nature rather than Russian. What I would like to do this afternoon is to talk on the topic dominant themes in Mao's Little Red Book. And I have six of these listed, and I think they will give you somewhat of an idea of what's in the book, what's going on in Chinese communism, and why it has a certain appeal to people that Russian communism does not have. Now, in order to understand why anybody would want to be a communist, and there are millions of people in the world who do, one has to understand what I call the faith or the religion of communism. And this is basically a belief that nature is on the side of communism, that there is a definite pattern to the way societies emerge, grow strong, and are replaced by other kind of societies, which is completely natural in origin. Marx called it materialistic. That there is a definite discernible pattern in nature of how this happens, and communism is the final form that this takes. The form of society and of economic structure which occurs just before it, just prior to its incipient stages, is capitalism. So, according to their theory, we are one step removed from communism, and we are moving in that direction. Since nature is the strongest force that there is in the world, you cannot fight nature, you can temporarily fight against nature, but you cannot permanently fight against nature. And so consequently, there is a complete faith, there is a blind faith that this is natural, that this is inevitable. Several passages, Mao himself also says that the world of man cannot for long survive against nature and the direction that it is going. So consequently, everything is on our side, everything is going for us. We ultimately are going to triumph, no matter how black it looks. Someday we are going to win. We cannot help but win. And this is what gives the basic impetus to anyone who is a communist, the belief that he's on the winning side, that no matter how many reverses his side experiences, ultimately they are going to win. And it is in this context that we have to understand Mao's comments in the late 1950s about the United States being a paper tiger. I'm sure you all know that expression, paper tiger. Two quotations are in Mao's Red Book, and one of these, at least, is one of the best known. tail end of this quotation. Was not Hitler a paper tiger? Was Hitler not overthrown? I also said that the Tsar of Russia, the Emperor of China, and Japanese imperialism were all paper tigers. As we know, they were all overthrown. U.S. imperialism has not yet been overthrown, and as if not bombed. I believe it also will be overthrown. It too is a paper tiger. This was at a speech in Moscow on November 18, 1957. The atom bomb is a paper tiger which U.S. reactionaries use to scare people. It looks terrible, but in fact it isn't. Of course the atom bomb is a weapon of mass slaughter. But the outcome of a war is decided by the people, not by one or two new types of weapons. This brings up the second point, the faith of communism. And this is the belief that the people, the masses of a country, once they understand communism, will support it. If communist revolutionaries come to the peasants of a country, the people who are downtrodden, who are living close to the liberal starvation, you come to them and you explain communist doctrine to them and communist hopes and communist dreams, these people will support you. In order to be successful in a country, then all that you need is the support of the people. And no matter how repressive a government you have, no matter how terrible its weapons, ultimately, if the people are for you, who can be against you? And it sounds rather faintly like a Bible passage, doesn't it? A Bible passage that says, if God be for us, who can be against us? Mao makes no bones about it. Chinese communism believes in God. Who is God? God is the will of the people. Whatever the people will is the religion of the Communist Party. The will of the people of the Communist Party is to fulfill. So on the one hand, there is a belief in nature. On the other hand, there is a belief that if people, the masses of people, not the middle class like us and the rich people, but if the bottom level people, the people that are living in the slums, the factory workers in the poor housing, the peasants with the tiny farms scratching out of their existence, that if communism and its goals are explained to them, they will support it. Of course, the general criticism of Guevara's campaign in Bolivia was that he never got the peasants on his side. The peasants never understood his cause, and matter of fact, he was somewhat brutal and superior in his dealing with the peasants, and the peasants turned on him. All right, now, how are you going to succeed in what you do? Basically, in Mao, there is a two-pronged attack. You seek to bring about your goals by means of political maneuvering and by means of war. These are two sides of the same kind of an attack, to attempt to bring about the end which you have in mind. For now, war is a good thing. Nothing wrong with war at all. It's one of the two techniques which you have to use. Sometimes the appropriate technique to use is diplomacy. Sometimes the appropriate technique to use is warfare. The secret of a successful campaign is to know when to use the proper technique. Sometime when you're involved with the United States and they want out, sometimes the appropriate technique is to carry on warfare in North Korea. Sometimes the proper technique is to conduct discussions in a pure conciliatory and peaceful at the diplomat's table, but you use both techniques in order to achieve the goal that you want to achieve. Ours is an old technique. Stalin used it also, particularly in the Cold War, after World War II. Sometimes he was busy campaigning for a mutual disarmament treaty, and then all the UN got excited and started swinging over to his side. And sometimes he was threatening to close down West Berlin. And then everybody kind of shuddered. So he moved from one to the other, whichever one he thought was going to be most successful in achieving the particular goal he wanted to achieve at a particular time. And since it is the ultimate goal, namely the happiness of everybody, that is the goal of communism, any means that you use to that end is good, so long as the means succeed, because it is the end that justifies the means in what you're doing. War is a continuation of politics by other means. When an obstacle is removed and our political aim is attained, then the war stops. Why keep on with a war when you've achieved the end you want to achieve? That's a waste of time and manpower. If the obstacle is not completely swept away, the war will have to continue until an aim is fully accomplished. Politics is war without bloodshed. War is politics with bloodshed. They're correlative things. Each one is just like the other one, and they differ simply in a few little characteristics, like people getting killed or not getting killed. But other than that, they're both techniques which are legitimate in achieving one's end. As I go along here and I make comments like that, whereby I'm speaking for Mao Zedong. So, a political technique is simply a peaceful way of, resolving a contradiction. Contradiction is a favorite word of Mao. Contradiction, not a grammatical expression or a logical expression, but a contradiction is a social expression. It's when there's a disagreement, when there's an antagonism. You and your boyfriend have an argument, that's a contradiction. What you attempt to do then is to resolve the contradiction. You know also there are peaceful and warlike ways of resolving this. Sometimes Mao uses the word struggle, which is a kind of a euphemism for cleaning up on somebody or killing them or going to war or something of that sort. But once again, it's a peaceful means or a non-peaceful means whereby you eliminate a disagreement. Now, there are a number of ways one can do this. Suppose that I disagree with somebody else. Well, I can get together with him, and I can talk it over with him. This is what Mao calls discussion. Or I can attempt in one way or another to change his basic attitude and his mind so that he now agrees with me. This is indoctrination. Or we may compromise discussion. Or I may shoot him, and we don't disagree anymore either. I'm right. I ask you, is there anybody that thinks that I'm not right? You know, nobody says no, so very obviously I'm right. This is war. Now, indoctrination is an extremely important doctrine in communism. It was all the way from Marx. Became even more important under Lenin, because Lenin connected to it the psychological doctrines of Pavlov about conditioning. And very briefly, it operates this way. The human being is a completely plastic being, unless he gets to be old and ossified and can't change his mind. You know, every teenager has encountered that with parents, haven't they? Where you no longer can, or on certain issues, you can't work them and get them to change their mind, you know, like making it 11 o'clock instead of 10 or 12 o'clock instead of 11 when you got to the end. Well, Pavlov said that the human being is completely plastic. It's like a hunk of clay. Consequently, you can condition it to believe anything you want it to believe, to have any values you want it to have, and there is nothing that is unchangeable in the human being. Consequently, indoctrination is simply applying the techniques of conditioning. And in areas which went under the aegis of communism. One of the very first things which was done in order to pacify the area and to change it from inimical territory to friendly territory was regular and frequent broadcasts or playing of tape recorders or phonograph recordings or lectures where someone simply came and presented the position of the Communist Party over and over and over and over again. Same thing was done with prisoners of war. Every day, regularly at 3 o'clock, you get them together and you tell them certain things. What happens now when the Chinese communists are involved in this is someone comes in and opens a little red book and he reads his text out of the communist Bible and then he delivers a short sermon on it. Well, the idea is if you do this long enough and you keep doing it over and over again, people will be conditioned to accept it. In other words, you don't prove or disprove anything. You condition people to accept something. You change their conditioning, and you get their conditioning the way you want it. In this way, they become the kind of people that you want. This is indoctrination. Now, war, of course, is the non-peaceful resolution of a conflict, and it is entered into once again in order to resolve a conflict. Every communist, this is another famous remark from Mao, every communist must grasp this truth. Political power grows out of the barrel of a gun. In other words, you have to engage in war, whether it be a matter of threatening to beat somebody up if he doesn't let you do what you want to do, you know, to engage in national wars or international wars, in order to achieve a political power and a political base. So war, number one, resolves the conflict when there is no other way of resolving it. When a nation or a group of nations or individuals in a country seem to be resisting indoctrination, seem to be unwilling to see the light and go communist, well, sometimes you simply have to go to war against them in order to, you know, to improve your position and resolve the conflict of them being your enemy. Secondly, and this is extremely important in Mao, because it's original to Mao, war is necessary because it gives an impetus to cultural advance. Without war, we tend not to advance culturally. Revolutionary war is an antitoxin which not only eliminates the enemy's poison, but also purges us, the communists, of our own filth. Every just revolutionary war is endowed with tremendous power and can transform many things or clear the way for their transformation. In other words, when you're starting to get kind of stodgy or things are, you know, you're getting kind of complacent or so on, you've got to fight to get yourself shaped up again. I think when we read a passage like this, we can understand what Mao started in China about a year or so ago, where everything was going very smoothly, and everybody was scared stiff of the Chinese. We were so scared stiff, we got ourselves stuck in the swamps of Vietnam. And all of a sudden, Mao turned the country upside down and instituted a new civil war. Why? Communism in China was getting filthy. The nation was losing its drive and its impetus. So what we have to do is turn the nation against itself. Brother fighting against brother, and what comes out of it will be better. We will have a new force, a new strength, a new belief in the goals of communism. So what seemed like a completely senseless move on the part of a senile old man makes perfectly good sense in terms of his overall theory, and you can see why he did it. I think a lot of his contemporaries are not too happy about it. Now, it goes along with the faith on the part of nature. I'm sure you've all run across Darwin's evolutionary theory, explaining how nature operates and how we get new forms and things of this sort. Basic principle is the survival of the fittest. All of nature is at war against itself, and only the fittest survive. This is a direct application of that principle to human society by Mao. If you have a kind of situation where your nation is starting to get kind of bureaucratic, where communism is simply accepted, it's institutionalized and so on, this is not good, because what will tend to happen is it will revert back to bourgeoisie bureaucracy. So what you have to do is upset the apple cart. Everybody's on his own now. The weaklings will get destroyed, the strong will emerge, and you will have a stronger nation than you had before, because the fittest will survive. Now, as you return to nature, and nature always picks the right ones to survive, and so we will be much better off than we were before. Now, when you find that your enemy is somebody that believes in war, and who sees war as a good, who is not afraid when you threaten that you will go to war with them, or when you rattle the atomic bomb and say, look, boy, we can level China, and there'll be very few people left. What do you do to intimidate somebody like this to keep him from engaging on what he calls wars of national liberation? It's rather hard to find anything that will scare somebody like this. And this is what makes Chinese communism, from a political standpoint, what makes Chinese communism such a difficult thing to deal with, because of the conventional devices that we have always operated with in order to keep aggressive nations in line, and to keep them from becoming expansionistic, the traditional kind of things that we have threatened them with has been war and its associated kind of things. And this doesn't faze Mao in the least. He's not afraid of war. As a matter of fact, he would prefer it. You get a good, healthy invasion by Chang from Formosa or something like that, you know, best thing in the world for the Chinese people, boy. It'll show up who the people are that don't support communism, you know, we'll shoot them, and it'll knock off our weakest people, and once we've gotten rid of Chang and his boys, we will be a stronger and healthier country than before we were invaded. See? So consequently, the kind of threats with which we think we have bring China in order to keep it from being expansionistic and dominating the Orient really don't mean anything to Mao. He couldn't care less. Alright, number three, the importance of change. Change is inevitable. Change always goes on. Well, this goes at least as far back as Heraclitus and Plato. So that's not a new idea, but there are some new twists to it. The history of mankind is one of continuous development from the realm of necessity to the realm of freedom. This process is never ending. In any society in which classes exist, class struggle will never end. Basic communist doctrine from Marx, and then also preserved by Lenin, was that the reason why we have problems in the world is because there are classes, and there are dominant classes and inferior classes, and the dominant classes sit on inferior classes and repress them. But in the process, what happens is a new class emerges, which gets things out of balance, and then it gets overturned, and you get a revolution, a turning around. And another class moves to the top, and then you get another class structure, you get another kind of society, another kind of economics, another kind of government. Then this changes the economic situation, produces another one. So you keep getting revolutions, and if you think of humanity as a ball, you see the ball keeps moving, and it's moving forward to a better and better kind of world. See, is the way nature is going, until the final move will be communism, where there will be no classes, be like a flat spot on the ball. See, the ball will stop, and that's where it will end. From then on, there will be no more wars or anything else like that. This is Marxist-Leninist doctrine, but not Mao. Mao says the ball will always keep rolling. It will never stop rolling. There will always be wars and rumors of war. There will also be struggle. Even in classless society, communist society, the struggle between the new and the old, between truth and falsehood, will never end. There will always be struggle. We will always have to resort to violent as well as peaceful means to resolve our contradictions. This is inevitable. This is in the nature of things. So change will always go on. We will never achieve this panacea that Marx talked about and that Lenin talked about, where all of a sudden here's the golden age and everybody will love everybody else and the lion will lie down with the lamb and there'll be no more problems. Mao says this will never happen. It's more realistic than the others. Not only is it inevitable, it is good that there is always change. Passages on that. Changes in society are due chiefly to the development of internal contradictions in society, disagreements, clashes of ideas, and so on. The contradiction between productive forces and the relations of production, contradiction between classes, contradiction between the old and the new, parents and kids. It is the development of these contradictions that pushes society forward. It gives the impetus for the supersession of the old society by the new. If the new society never came up with new ideas or was critical of the old society, it never advanced. The young didn't see through some of the weaknesses of what was in the world that they encountered. The world would never get any better. And so change is good. There must always be this criticism of the status quo and the looking for something better than that. This is what keeps the ball rolling. You notice how attractive he sounds? He's all in favor of teenagers being in rebellion against the world. So the Red Guards he developed, and that was Mao's teenage group. If there were no contradictions in the party, if the party was always in agreement with itself, and if there were no ideological struggles to resolve, notice the word struggles. The struggle is not where we sit down and discuss it peacefully over a table. You know, we discuss it the way Al Capone used to discuss things in Chicago with rival gangs. If there were no ideological struggles to resolve, then the party's life would come to an end. So there has to be struggle and disagreement within the party also. You don't find that in the Russian brand. You're supposed to reach agreement. You attempt to reach agreement. The easiest way to reach agreement is to get a dictatorship, which Russia had for most of its years during which it existed as a communist type country. There is the aiming at harmony and peace within the party in Russian communism. There is a twofold aiming in Mao. On the one hand, unification of the party, but on the other hand, struggle of ideas with one another to improve the party. Never satisfied with the party, which, once again, I think is much more realistic than the Russian communist approach, and of course, thereby makes Mao's type of communism a much more difficult one to combat than the Russian kind. Number four. A fourth dominant theme in Mao Zedong concerns itself with the relationship between the armed forces and the people. Now Mao distinguishes three different entities in the nation. The party, the people, and the army. There are three significant entities. The party probably would never constitute more than about 10% of the population of the country. If it got bigger than this, it would get unwieldy, unworkable. You're better off having 90% of the people non-communist. The people determine the goals of the nation by their needs or their expressed wants, if they're able to articulate them. It is the function of the party to work out the structure and the apparatus and the technique whereby you achieve the goals the people want, and it's the function of the army to enforce it and to handle propaganda for the party and to indoctrinate the people so that they become more and more friendly to communist goals. Well, what about the relationship between the army and the people? This is extremely important for reasons which I'll shortly explain. The first goal of the army is to win the support of the people. And the way that it is to set about doing it is this. First of all, I need a general coordination. The political work of the army is guided by three basic principles. One, the principle of unity between officers and men, which, explaining in detail, Mao says, eliminating the distinction between the commissioned and the non-commissioned member of the army, so that they are all equal, they get the same food, they get the same housing, they fight together, they live together. We eliminate this traditional distinction, aristocratic distinction in the armed forces. Number two, when there is an operation to be carried out, and orders come down from the Supreme Headquarters about it, it is discussed between officers and men. The men are told why they are doing what they are doing and what the objective is. There is a discussion back and forth between officers and men on the best tactic to use in order to achieve it, and when they achieve unanimity, then they go ahead and fight. This is a very different way from fighting war than we're accustomed to. Secondly, the principle of unity between the army and the people, which means maintaining a discipline that forbids the slightest violation of the people's interests. The third one is a principle of disintegrating the enemy troops and giving lenient treatment to prisoners of war. What's the method? The three main rules of discipline, that was the first point. The three main rules of discipline are as follows. One, obey orders in all your actions. That's always been the case in every army. Number two, do not take a single needle or piece of thread from the masses. Number three, turn in everything captured. You don't liberate anime cameras, binoculars, and so on, and then send them home to the masses. The 8 points for attention are as follows. One, speak politely. Two, pay fairly for what you buy. Three, return everything you borrow. Four, pay for anything you damage. Five, do not hit or swear at people. Six, do not damage crops. Seven, do not take liberties with women. Eight, do not ill-treat captives. Well, you can imagine how a populace of a country would react if an army passed through and followed those rules. You can imagine how they would feel toward that army, especially if the other army didn't. Even if the other army was their army. Well, as far as we've been able to tell, with very few exceptions, in the Chinese Civil War against Chiang's army, Mao's army followed these rules. Chiang's army was very brutal. There were many atrocities. So you can imagine when the war was over how the feeling of the general populace was. You know, and if they were asked, you want Chiang's army back to liberate you? They'd say, no, thank you. We've had nothing to do with liberation. We buried most of the people we liberated. The rest are in hospitals. We'll try Mao for a while. And Mao was quite successful for a while in China, because of the way his army had behaved. Now, we do not hear very much here in the United States about the behavior of the North Vietnamese army. Every once in a while we hear a little bit about it, but not much is reported about this, about the North Vietnamese army's behavior toward the South Vietnamese people. We hear a lot about what the Viet Cong do. They're separate from the North Vietnamese Army and our South Vietnamese Revolutionary Group. We've had some prisoners of war come back from North Vietnam, and we've been told by them that they've all been treated well, that they have been fed, housed, clothed well, and that they have nothing to complain about. And we know that General Giap, who is the general leader, has been for about the last year and a half with North Vietnamese war strategy, and was the general responsible for defeating the French and pushing them out of Vietnam, that he is an avid disciple of Mao Zedong. As far as we can tell, and I say this on the basis of what I just said, that we hear very little, that our armed forces permit very little information on this topic out of Vietnam. As far as we can tell, that there is little or no complaint about the behavior towards civilians by the North Vietnamese. There have been many complaints about us, particularly about our bombing, and there have been many more complaints about the Viet Cong, who are a South Vietnamese group. So it does suggest that Giap is following Mao's rules about the way an army operates. And you can imagine once the dust settles, if you have a vote in South Vietnam, you know, whose army would you like to have here? You can have some kind of an idea of what the answer might very well be. So this kind of an approach by armed forces is extremely effective with the people that you want to affect. Because if you are, you know, a minority group trying to take over a country in a civil war, or if you are involved in what Mao calls a war of national liberation to take over another country, what the winning of the war and the losing of the war is not, you know, whose army has control of it, but on whose side are the people. Because in the long run, it is the people who are going to determine who's going to be around there. Now, we've seen since World War II a great many countries in Eastern Europe that are under the control of Russia. It doesn't mean that every Sunday they invite a Russian soldier over for Sunday dinner. Far from it. Given the least little chance, they will revolt. It's important to notice what's going on in Czechoslovakia right now. Czechoslovakian people are very smart people, they're very intelligent people, they're highly educated. They have been for many, many years. When Hitler moved into Czechoslovakia, they knew better than to protest. They knew they weren't going to get far. They fought a little while, but when they saw the situation was hopeless, they capitulated and tolerated the Germans. The Russians moved in a few days ago, and the president said, you know, don't resist, it's hopeless. We don't want a bloodbath in our country. What is happening now in Czechoslovakia? They're busy with civil disobedience and passive resistance. They are busy making life difficult, with a smile, for the Russian invaders. They had a nationwide strike the other day. Everybody got sick at once. They couldn't go to work. And they were all full of apologies. You know, they apologized all over for the fact that the Russian barracks didn't have any heat or electricity or anything else. But you know, they had this national epidemic. And so on. They ended this war. There are many ways to fight a war other than confrontation with war. And only a stupid man fights when he's outnumbered, fights, you know, with direct confrontation. So that situation is far from a peaceful one, and World War II is far from over in East Europe. Certainly it is far from over in Germany. And so what Mao is pointing out is that what you have to have is the people on your side. So you win the war and you lose the peace. You get control of the country and everybody hates you. This is the thing that the Jewish people are concerned, not Jewish people, Israeli people are concerned about right now. All of a sudden they have gobbled up a whole bunch of territory and everybody hates them there. So what good is it? See? You now have a problem of guerrilla behavior, sabotage, and all sorts of other things, what you have to do now is fight the real war to win the affection, the hearts of the people. And this is by far the more difficult war. All right, so this is how they have to operate in relation to the enemy. He also says something else which goes contrary to the traditional rules of warfare. Our policy toward prisoners captured, and he was talking about in the war against the Japanese before World War II, is to set them all free, except for those who have incurred the bitter hatred of the masses and must receive capital punishment and whose death sentence has been approved by higher authorities. Among prisoners, those who were coerced into joining revolutionary forces and who are more or less inclined toward the revolution should be won over in large numbers to work for our army. The rest should be released. And if they fight us and are captured again, should again be set free. We should not insult them, take away their personal effects, or try to exact recantations from them, but without exception should treat them sincerely and kindly. This should be our policy, however reactionary it may be. It is a very effective way of isolating the camp of reaction. Now, every prisoner of war expects that he's going to be kept a prisoner, and so he's going to try to escape. He expects that he will be there will be efforts to brainwash him. He expects that he will suffer privation. He expects that they will try torture and other devices to learn everything of military value from him that they can. Consequently, if none of these things happen and he's released, this weakens his patriotism. This makes him a little bit less effective soldier for his side, because he cannot understand why an obviously intelligent enemy will release him. And so it weakens his resolve to resist. This is part of the secret behind Mao's technique. Weaken the resolve of the enemy to fight against you in every way that you can, in as subtle a ways that you can. Weaken his will to continue the battle against you. We've seen this rather effectively in the United States in the last couple of years in the Vietnam situation, where there's been a radical shift in popular attitude toward the Vietnamese war. I don't mean to suggest that Mao has accomplished this, but we have seen this kind of thing happen. And it becomes exceedingly difficult to continue to wage a war where there is less and less popular support for the war, and it becomes increasingly difficult to fight bravely as a soldier if you are beginning to lose faith in your cause. And so this is behind the technique in the dealing with prisoners of war, that you attempt to deal with a prisoner of war in such a way that you weaken, at a minimum, you weaken his resolve to continue fighting against you. If at all possible, you attempt to gain him for your side. Talking about the techniques of guerrilla warfare, Mao says, your weapons and your personnel are at the front. Your weapons are in the hands of the enemy. Don't get them. Your army is fighting on the side of the enemy at the present time. Capture them and win them over and add them to your forces. This is how you win a war. Interestingly enough, apart from the armed side, this is the technique of Christianity. Where are the ministers of tomorrow in a pagan land? The pagans. You go over and convert them and send them out to preach the gospel, see? This is the basic evangelism technique which Mao has adapted to, I don't know whether he learned this from the Christian missionaries, but at any rate, this is the technique that he has adapted for his own uses. You go into a country with three or four revolutionaries. You develop an army, you steal weaponry, and gradually you attempt to take over the country from within by means of its own people. You do not invade it with a large army, which is what the Russian communists almost always did. I take that, they always did. They attempted internal subversion, but the only places where they were successful was where they took over a country, which is Czechoslovakia again, by means of massive force. Once again, massive force, Mao is right in this, massive force is the least successful way of winning. Brutality is the least successful way of winning battle. It may be short-term successful, but long-term it is failure. It creates more antagonisms than it eliminates. And so consequently, Mao's type of communism once more is a much more dangerous type of communism if it's turned against you. Of course it is turned against us. He makes no bones about it. Number five topic, the hierarchy of obediences, I call this. The relationship of various entities, individuals in society to one another. The discipline of the party. The individual is subordinate to the organization. I don't count for anything except as far as I am of value to the party. The minority is subordinate to the majority. If there is a disagreement within the party or within the nation, which we cannot settle, finally the majority's will has to prevail and the minority either has to join the majority or we have to obey it. Number three, the lower level is subordinate to the higher level. The party is at top, then comes the army, and then comes the people. The army must recognize that it is subordinate to the party, and the people must recognize that they fall under the army and under the party. Or the entire membership is subordinate to the central committee. Whoever violates these articles of discipline disrupts party unity. If then everything is under the central committee, when the Congress meets, as it meets in Russia, there is really no reason for the Congress to debate anything which is proposed to it by the Central Committee. When people come up for election, there is really no reason to have two candidates for an office because everybody is subordinate to the central part, the Central Committee, and so the Central Committee says that something should be done, we understand it. This is only good sense. Otherwise, you disrupt party unity. You get terrible fights like that in the United States every 4 years when Democrats and Republicans call one another all kind of dirty names. They tear up the unity of the country. They never understand how the United States can go back together again after a political year. They expect every one of these things will explode off into outer space or something like that. Because in Russia, you know, nobody would ever call anybody else the kind of things Republicans call Democrats, and Democrats call Republicans. And then they read speeches like Nixon's speeches, where he talks about how Johnson is leading the nation down to instruction and destruction, and they agree. And talks about how stupid Humphrey is, and McCarthy is an even working income group, and nothing more disastrous could happen to the nation than that either one of them would be elected. You know, and then McCarthy and Humphrey stop hitting one another and say what they think about Richard Nixon and how stupid he was, and how even more stupid he has gotten since he was vice president, you know, and they want to save, they really don't want to be president, but they want to save the country from Nixon. You know, and then George Wallace says, of course, you know, neither one of them are worth anything, you know, but if you want a real president, elect me and so on. Well, when you read all the political propaganda that goes against, you don't understand Americans and how they think about things, you can see disaster coming every 4 years. Whereas in a communist country, you know, life goes on. Elections come up, the candidates are there, and you vote for them, and things go on smoothly. See, nobody calls anybody else a dirty name. Everybody's for a candidate. Everybody votes for him. There are no split votes or anything like that. No breaches have to get healed. Much more better way to run the country is the way they think. Okay. is a hierarchy. Everybody knows his spot, and everybody stays in his spot. Anybody that gets out of line is put back in line with proper apologies or he gets dealt with. Everybody has his role to play in relation to the party and the greater goals of the society. Secondly, this is extremely important, the principle of self-criticism and indoctrination. Self-criticism means simply that periodically every member of the party is expected to stand up before the other members of the local group or whatever level he's on and confess his sins against the party. Any disobedient thoughts that he has had, any jealousies or any other kind of feelings that he has had, which would be subversive of unity of the party. In other words, you don't simply do what you're supposed to do, but you have to reveal the innermost workings of your mind. In other words, the function of self-criticism is that every member of the party becomes a completely public person. Then he loses all privacy. Now, privacy is a dirty word in communism. Where there is privacy, sabotage can occur. There can be the seeds of disunity. And so everything must be public. Everything must be seen under the naked light of day. The only way that you can get into a person's mind is by having him open it up to you. And so consequently, self-criticism is a technique in which every member of the party is expected to engage, so that he becomes a completely public person. But what happens when you become completely public? What happens is you cease to be a person. You are completely known. And one of the basic characteristics of a person is that there is something mysterious. There is something that is known only to him and God, and there are some things that are known only by God. This is the essence of personality. If you haven't got this, you cannot be a person. And so you lose your personhood. You lose your personality. You become a functionary. You talk party language and party line. Ultimately, you become incapable of anything other than this. All you can do is talk stereotype-type language. And you're not trying to con anybody. This is the only way you are able to talk. This is the only way you are able to think. You have become completely programmed in a communist way. And so it is tremendously effective to achieve party unity. Where does the personality come then? What becomes the person? The person then is the party. The person who transfers to the party, and the party becomes the person. And it functions as a person for you as a member of the party also. You do things because you love the party. But why do we do things? We do things because we love God, and because we love our parents and our kids and our buddies and so on. We love people. We love persons. God's a person. Well, if you're communist, you do it for the love of the party. The party achieves a personality for you. And so your personality disappears, and the party then achieves the personality which you have. Along with this then of self-criticism, whereby you empty yourself of your faults, and of your personality, you then get filled with indoctrination. You get conditioned to be a certain kind of function. And so this is how it then gets achieved. Alright, the final topic then is intellectuals and artists. Now, since it's a war of ideas as well as other kind of warfare, supposedly the people that would be most difficult to handle would be intellectuals, like all of you, and artists, maybe some of you. Because, you know, they're always contrary critters, aren't they? They're always, again, all sorts of things. Yeah, they wear queer clothes, a lot of them grow beards, you know, and things of that sort. The eccentrics of society, they are not part of the masses. So, what does Mao have to say about this? Two very interesting things, which are quite different from what Marx had said and what Lenin and Stalin said and did. One of these is a famous quotation. Let a hundred flowers blossom and a hundred schools of thought contend. This is the policy for promoting the progress of the arts and the sciences and a flourishing socialist culture in our land. This is 1957. Different forms and styles of art should develop freely. Different schools in science should contend freely. We think that it is harmful to the growth of art and science if administrative measures are used to impose one particular style of art or school of thought and to ban another. Questions of right and wrong in the arts and sciences should be settled through free discussion in artistic and scientific circles and through practical work in these fields. They should not be settled in summary fashion. This is the famous Hundred Flowers speech, comment of Mao, sometimes referred to as the Hundred Butterflies remark. The idea coming up for complete academic freedom for the intellectual and artistic world. This came at a time when nobody anywhere in the world had any use for Russia on this score. The general approach of Lenin and after him Stalin was that it is the function of the intellectuals to work for the society. It is the function of the artists to use their artistic techniques to indoctrinate the people, make posters and other things of this sort. Every movie that came out of Russia starred a tractor. The hero was a tractor, you know, and some beautiful young girl fell in love with the tractor, and the eternal triangle was the boyfriend, the tractor, and her. Finally, she gives up the idea of marrying him and going through a cushy life, and we see her driving off through Siberia into the sunset aboard her tractor, going out to plow some virgin lands to raise wheat for Mother Russia. Typical Russian movie. See, hundreds of them come out like this. Propaganda for the cause. Live for the party and its goals, things of this sort. All right, so Mao comes out with this. He comes out with another one where, I won't read it to you, but I'll tell you what he says. He says, it is not enough for art to be politically right. It must meet aesthetic criteria or it is junk. It must meet aesthetic criteria because it cannot possibly succeed, and therefore I am against slogan and poster type art. You know, and artists all around the world said, hooray for Mao! And the hard-pressed communist parties in non-communist countries breathed a sigh of relief and said, you know, here's a product we can defend. And they go to the college communities, you know, and where the intellectuals were, and they go to the artist colonies and said, see, you can be a communist. See what Mao had to say. See, this is real communism, you know, not that stupid Russian variety. This is real communism. We are for intellectuals. We are for artists. And the population started going up by leaps and bounds in communist parties as a result of this speech by Mao. And 1 year later, Mao suppressed all thought in China and killed off a lot of intellectuals who were saying that Mao type communism was absolutely stupid. So they got shot. And other ones were put in jail, and there has been no freedom of thought in China since then. But it is part of a theory, and it's in the book, and there is absolutely nothing in the book to contradict that. So at least it is for export, and apparently at the time when he said it, he meant it. And going by what he says, rather than some of the expediencies of the things which he has done in China, you can see where Chinese communism can have a certain traction that Russian communism has never had. Because of this, it is a much more difficult intellectual movement as well as political movement to combat and to overcome, because it has so many naturally attractive things about it. I made a comment about 2 weeks ago. Some lady in the audience snorted when I said that and was very unhappy. But I said, there is a basic, in quotation marks, humanitarianism about Mao Zedong's communism that you do not find in Russian communism. Russian communism treats people like dogs, maybe that's because Pavlov was a Russian. Chinese communism treats people like people. And Mao, of course, comes from a country with an intellectual and cultural tradition which is thousands of years old, one of the ancient cultural traditions of the world. And from the peasant on up, you have cultured people. Well, if you are going to win that country, you do not treat them like dogs. And so this may account for the fact that Mao is a Chinese. Thinks more ways than he realized, like a Chinaman, that you get a different variety of communism coming from Mao. And it is a variety which is very concerned about people's feelings, about being liked by people and approved of by people. And so consequently, where you are in a war, and if your enemy is a brutal pug, it is not very hard to hate him and to fight with all your heart against him. But when he is a cultured gentleman that drinks all the right wines and eats all the right kind of food, you know, it's very hard to hate him with all your heart. And so this is what makes Mao's kind of approach very difficult to work against. And there's one thing I'm not going to work against, and that's the supper bell.